I'm your host, Michael Callahan. This is Where We Go Next. And whether it's 2009's Tea Party movement on the right, 2011's Occupy Wall Street movement on the left, or the populist movements growing within both parties today, a lot of Americans agree this economy doesn't seem to be working for them. Globalization has shipped jobs overseas, multinational corporations help craft legislation behind closed doors, and our very government, that is supposed to be by and for the people, too often puts the interests of big businesses ahead of our own. Our guest this week points towards a bold solution that puts citizens first. Grace Blakely is an economist, journalist, and political commentator. She is the author of Stolen: How to Save the World from Financialization, The Corona Crash: How the Pandemic Will Change Capitalism, and her newest work, Vulture Capitalism: Corporate Crimes, Backdoor Bailouts, and the Death of Freedom. Grace, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, I am so glad that we're both glad that you're here. You've created a bit of a problem for me, Grace, because usually when I'm reading a book, the text that demands to be highlighted because of the density of its information or eloquence of its argument is easily identifiable because it happens once or twice per page at most. Here, however, the difficulty was figuring out what not to highlight, so thank you for that. But let's start with a title, The Death of Freedom. That really grabs the eye right away. Now, although the US and Britain share quite a few cultural and political touchstones, freedom here in the United States is likely used more often and has a greater cultural weight to it than perhaps it does in the UK, for better or worse. So what does freedom mean in the context of the title of your newest work, and what does it mean to you?
Great opening question. And I'm glad that you picked up on that, because I actually chose the subtitle of the book, whereas the title was a joint effort with me and the publishers. But I really wanted to bring through the centrality of this argument about freedom, because basically in the 1980s, when we had the election of what I call in the book neoliberal government, so these are people like Thatcher and Reagan, who were very intent on privatization and tax cuts and these kind of, in inverted commas, free market policies that we've become very used to. They really focused on freedom. And their whole argument went back to the argument of a well-known neoliberal economist called Friedrich Hayek. And he said basically that when you had social democratic governments spending lots of money on healthcare, education, social services, etc., that inevitably was leading societies to kind of totalitarianism and removing personal freedom, basically by transforming markets in which there's no centralized authority that makes decisions into these kind of planned economies in which the state decides everything. And their whole argument was to say we need to create more space for the market, shrink the state, and in doing so, expand the realm of human freedom. Now, there are plenty of problems with that view of freedom, because it really centers on your freedom as a consumer in a free market. But my argument in the book isn't really to do with that. It's actually about how the free market turn undermined the very principles it was supposed to promote. So it actually undermined even this very kind of narrow view of freedom that politicians like Thatcher and Reagan held, because it actually led to a greater amount of planning in the economy. It was just that the planning that we see is now being undertaken by big corporations, or businesses that are in the pockets of those big corporations, or financial institutions, or unaccountable international organizations. So rather than having nice free markets with lots of small producers and governments that are completely separate to those markets, we have this kind of monstrous, toxic melding of public and private power, which has basically allowed elites at the top of the economy, the most powerful institutions in business and finance, to create their own spheres of power. So you see this with the big monopolistic firms like Amazon, the big financial institutions, the big tech companies. They have an immense amount of power within their markets over consumers, over workers, over the direction of innovation. But they've also become very close with governments and have actually undermined the ability or willingness of governments to regulate them, to tax them properly, to do what governments are allegedly supposed to do, even to enforce and promote free markets. So rather than free markets, as the neoliberals wanted, we have these corporate monopolies and oligopolies and oligarchic systems of government that cater to the interests of the wealthy and powerful rather than democracies. And this has really drastically undermine people's freedom in loads of different ways. So if you just take the very narrow neoliberal view of freedom, just your freedom as a consumer, this has been drastically undermined by the growth of corporate power. You have this facade of freedom when you see lots of different brands on your shelves, but actually most of those brands are owned ultimately by a couple of massive corporations that hold huge market share. So you don't even have real consumer choice. Then as a worker, your freedom is drastically limited because labor markets have been enclosed by big corporations that have huge control over wages, over conditions, and your capacity to unionize has been undermined by a government that is trying to make that very difficult for workers. And what's more, and I think that the key argument in the book is that because we don't really have free markets and because we don't really have democracy, there's no accountability when people at the top get things wrong. And they get things wrong a lot, which basically means that the average person is constantly faced with all of these disasters. I look at the example of Boeing, of how corporate greed brought this firm down.
Quite the terrifying example.
Exactly. Yeah. And you're faced with all these examples of unethical behavior or corruption, and yet you feel completely unable to do anything about it.
Yes. One of the ways that you demonstrate how the average person walking around, whether they're in the UK, the US, or anywhere in the world, is really powerless to affect kind of anything in their lives as it relates to the marketplace. You start the book, quote, "When you wake up in the morning, the first thing you do is probably pick up your phone. That phone is made of rare earth metals, which were likely extracted from a country like the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where rebel groups use the revenues from mining these minerals to purchase weapons," end quote. And you just go on and on throughout a person's day about how basically every single thing they're doing and using is the result of this larger system that is almost completely outside of their control, that is often doing corrupt, violent, unethical things. But we, as the average person walking about living our lives, have really no way to even affect any change to any of those bad things that are happening. You do such a great job of kind of setting up the problem, which is that we are kind of helpless within our own societies, whether they're democratic or not.
Yeah, exactly. That particular intro was inspired by a US TV show that you and your listeners might or might not know called The Good Place.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, it's this brilliant show that I watched from beginning to end. And the idea is that people accrue points over the course of their lives based on whether or not they've been good or bad. And then the show is set in the afterlife, basically, what we think is the afterlife. And the people with the most points allegedly having gone to heaven, and those with not very many points have gone to hell. And they realize over the course of the series that the system is all messed up because good people keep getting sent to hell. And the thing that they realize at the end is that even good actions in the world that we have today, like buying a bunch of flowers for your mum, actually ends up creating all of these massive negative consequences because those flowers were harvested using highly exploitative labor in completely unsustainable ways and then shipped over the world, creating massive carbon emissions. And the processes through which all of these goods that we use every day are produced are just so unethical that it was basically impossible for the average person to be good. And that's, I think, what I really wanted to bring through with that example, because we are bombarded all the time with ads and people trying to influence us to consume ethically, in inverted commas, to be sustainable, to reduce our carbon footprint, as though that is somehow a solution to all of the problems that we see all around the world every day. And I wanted to show that even that kind of attempt at ethical consumption ultimately cannot insulate someone as an individual from all of the kind of toxic systems that underpin global capitalism. So basically, it underpins this feeling that The Good Place highlights, that like there is no escape from these ultimately really unethical systems. But what I wanted to also show in the book is that there is an escape, but the escape comes not through individualism, so not through just changing your individual consumption habits, but through collectivism. So coming together with other people like you to demand systems change, not just individual change. And that's, I think, really the core message of the book, is if we want anything to change, there's no one coming to save us, basically. We can't rely on nice politicians doing good things unless they're held to account by a wider movement. We can't rely on bosses increasing wages unless they're held to account by workers. It really is a call to arms, I guess, to like build up these social movements that can hold people in positions of power to account.
To build on this, I'd love for you to walk us through the idea of the bee versus the architect.
Yes, I love this. This is my favorite quote from Karl Marx. where he talks about how bees create these amazing structures in their hives that would put to shame even the best of architects. But the difference between the architect and the bee is that the architect is capable of imagining what he wants to build before he builds it, then brings that imaginary structure into reality. And what Marx is highlighting here is that workers and people aren't just robots and they're not just animals. We're not pre-programmed entities that can just be used as inputs to production. We are these immensely creative, powerful, intelligent beings that are constantly seeking to change the world around us, to influence the world around us, and then to do so as part of these collectives. That is something that has really been stripped away under modern capitalism. It's just our creative and imaginative collective powers. And this is all the more the case the lower you are down the value chain. So for someone working in exploitative conditions in China, they're just an input to machinery. For someone working in a coffee shop in Costa or Starbucks, they're just a kind of input to production. Maybe you get a little bit more creative capacity if you work in, say, advertising. But even then, it's still very limited. And lots of creative people get very frustrated with the limitations on their ability to actually use their brains rather than just hunt for profits all the time. This is a kind of Marxist critique of the alienation that comes from working in a system where all of the resources are controlled by somebody else. There are only a very few really privileged people in the world economy who genuinely get to create things for the joy of creating things, or even to come up with new innovations because they genuinely want to solve a problem. Most of the time, our entire economy is just oriented towards profit without any thought for the human consequences. And Marx's argument was that that's inevitable in the kind of system that we've created, and that if we want to change it, if we want to build a different kind of world, then it has to rely on us cooperating to take control of these systems that are currently dominated by a small elite. And in the book, I look at some examples of times this has actually happened in human history. So my favorite example, and the example that The Architect and the Bee comes from, because one of the people involved in it wrote this book called The Architect and the Bee, is the Lucas Plan. And this was an aerospace company in Britain in the 1970s that was on its way to going under and had this really strong and powerful union. And the unionists all came together and said, we want to put together a plan to save this firm from bankruptcy and just transform the way that it works. So they drew on all of the skills of all of the workers in the organization and came up with this incredible document that listed how they could transform this company from an arms manufacturer into a democratically owned and run producer of socially useful technologies. And it was this incredible document that brought together all different sections of British society to say that these guys had achieved something really remarkable. Ultimately, it was crushed by Thatcher as part of this ironically termed free market revolution. What I argue in the book is that the free market revolution was never really about freeing markets. It just ends up creating monopolies. Instead, it was about ensuring or promoting, maximizing the power of bosses over that of workers. So the Lucas Plan is, I think, this fantastic example, and there are lots of other examples that I list in the book, of the astonishing creative power that human beings have when they come together to design and redesign their worlds, and how that power is just so limited and closed off in the kind of capitalist economies that we have today.
One of the insights of Marxism, to quote you from an interview you had with Politics Joe, is, quote, it's this class-divided society oriented around the production of commodities which are sold for profit. And that is undertaken through this class division, this social division of labor, where working people, the people who are forced to sell their labor power, are exploited by the ones who own things, end quote. And I'm not unsympathetic to this view. I can see that there's truth in it, quite a bit of truth in it, actually. I've seen friends and family be exploited by their employers through the inherent power imbalance that arises between the person cutting the check and the person dependent on that check. I've seen it in my own industry. I work in entertainment here in LA, first in film production, now in advertising. I've witnessed workers be mistreated on set, verbally and mentally abused, overworked, 14, 16, 18, 20-hour days. We're not out of the ordinary on a film set. VFX artists are underpaid and overworked to the point of exhaustion, only to lose their next job to a company out of Bangladesh that underbid them. In the gaming industry, it seems every 6 months, there's a new expose that comes out detailing how developers on some AAA $100+ million title are abused, exploited, and undervalued only for their game that they slaved over to make hundreds of millions, even billions of dollars in profit. I've personally experienced abuse. I get it and I condemn it. But I think the wrinkle I want to add, and I want to get your thoughts on this, I've also seen people be treated very well in their jobs. I've seen people be mentored by those in senior positions and then use that knowledge to grow their skill set and then end up in a well-paying, genuinely rewarding position at a job that they love with coworkers who appreciate them and that they appreciate. I've seen people use the knowledge and money they've acquired on the job to then open their own business. I've seen my own father and mother do this. It was a lifelong dream of theirs. And then they went on to treat their employees fairly. So yes, there is abuse and yes, there is exploitation. I think that anyone who would argue against that point is either blind or willingly dumb. And especially when it comes to the most powerful companies who are in bed with the government, right? This kind of corporate cronyism that you highlight in this book so well. I agree that that needs drastic reform. But there is a part of me that wonders, at least on the ground level, right, where I can see with my own eyes, how much of this is a systems problem versus a people problem. Because working for a bad boss at a bad company with bad incentives is bad. But if you work for a good boss at a good company with good incentives, that can lead to good things. What are your thoughts on this?
So I think the most important point here is that we need to be able to analyze capitalism as a global system. We like to think of domestic economies as though there's such thing as a domestic economy, and then look at the class structure of that economy as saying something about the way the world works, right? And a big argument, and an argument that I address in the book that we've seen, is that we've had the rise of well-paid, stable, vaguely enjoyable forms of labor in the rich world and the rise of the middle class, basically, and that that's something that can be replicated globally. But if you actually look at the vast majority of work that's undertaken on the planet, it's undertaken in horrendously exploitative conditions where those generous and human relationships are very limited. So it's sweatshops in China and Southeast Asia and India and commodities mining in Africa. And this is really what generates the stuff that is the foundation of the global economy. So the kind of expansion of service work in the rich world is actually dependent upon an expansion of immensely exploitative manufacturing and extractive labor in the rest of the world. And when you look at the global economy, the division of labor that you see looks a lot more like the, say, division of labor that you would have seen within the UK in like the 1860s, in that you have a very large and hyper-exploited class of workers producing things, a kind of small to medium-sized managerial class doing things like finance operations, managing the labor of everyone else, advertising, etc., and then a very small owning class that owns all the stuff. What's happened with globalization is that those managerial positions have become concentrated in the rich world with relatively better conditions, whilst the highly exploited labor has been concentrated in the poor world. And that's how we've stabilized our democracies, basically, and convinced people that capitalism isn't inherently exploitative. It's by providing a certain section of the global economy and an important section of the electorate in rich countries with relatively better paid jobs that have, you know, slightly more autonomy and freedom, and concentrating really horrendously exploitative labor in the rest of the global economy. But it's critical to point out that all of that service work is premised upon the manufacturing and extractive work that's taking place everywhere else. You couldn't have a big professional managerial class if it wasn't managing anything. And the thing that is managing is this massive globalized production process that largely takes place elsewhere. So if you look at like the vast mass of working people around the world, they do exist in horrendously exploitative and oppressive conditions. And the fact that there's like this slither of people who don't doesn't really undermine this argument that capitalism is inherently exploitative. But there's another point here that I think is really important, which is that as we've seen global growth slowing, even those kind of professional managerial jobs, and actually crucially, as we've seen AI and technology play a more important role, even those jobs have become what David Graeber would call become more bullshit jobs, right? With less kind of creative capacity, often lower pay. A lot of those jobs are being destroyed or continuously outsourced. Some of them are being taken up by AI. So there is this like hollowing out of that middle class, and that work is becoming often harder, longer hours, less creative, and more difficult and more challenging. And there are fewer people doing it. I use the example in the book of call center workers. This is supposed to be an example of like a cushy, easy job with potential for bettering yourself and getting up the hierarchy. And actually, when you look at the way in which these people are monitored often using technologies to make sure that they are literally going to the toilet once a day. It's the same with Amazon workers in rich countries as well. Then the highly exploitative relationships that exist within those sectors become much clearer. So what I would say is that, of course, there are nice employers. There are small and medium-sized businesses that exist within their local communities, treat their workers nicely. There are even nice employers within big companies. This is not a critique of individuals. There are often good people in all the systems that we've created. The issue is that it comprises a vanishingly small proportion of the total economic activity that takes place within a capitalist economy, the vast majority of which is really dependent upon hyper-exploitation of the poorest people on the planet.
Several years ago, this was late 2019. For context, I'm a freelance creative. I'm a commercial director. And I went through a period in the second half of 2019 where just for a confluence of events, I just went months without any work. And I eventually decided, hey, you know what? There's this flexible option out there. I saw it advertised on my phone at some point, and I was like, I'm going to do it. I'm going to deliver packages for Amazon. It allowed me to use my own car. All I had to do was just drive to a local delivery center. I would have like a 3 or 4 hour delivery window. I'd have packages assigned to me, and I would make anywhere between, this was the Christmas season, so it was higher, anywhere between like $17 and $21 an hour for 4 hours of work. And it was flexible. And I was like, this is a great idea. And then I arrive, and more often than not, I would say probably 8 times out of 10, I was the only white guy there. And more often than not, the only person who wasn't an immigrant there. And that was the first thing that kind of jumped out at me. And I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense. But, you know, let's give this job a try. So the way that they had us do these deliveries is they had everything mapped out in this app. So you'd have this app, and it was all very systematized in a very efficient way, of course, that befitted Amazon. That makes sense. I've ordered from Amazon. I know how efficient they are. They'd basically have all your packages condensed into, let's say, a 2 or 3 mile radius. So all the houses are pretty close to one another, which makes sense. Seems easy enough. And I'm like, well, I have 3 hours and 50 some odd packages, however much it was. That seems doable. But on my very first day delivering, I realized this is actually so tightly scheduled. And it was in Los Angeles, so there was not an abundance of parking, especially in like the 5 to 6 p.m. window when people were coming home from work, that I realized on my first day, if I don't park illegally and sprint sometimes to these homes to drop off these packages, scan them, and then back to my car, I won't make my time. And on the very first night that I was delivering, I was like, let me see if I can just park legally, follow the law. Because if I park illegally and get a ticket, Amazon has said in their small print that they're not going to be liable for reimbursing me for the ticket that I get while driving for them. And so my very first night there, I'm parking legally, looking for parking, circling blocks, etc. And I get a call an hour and a half into my 3 hour shift saying it was my first warning. I get 3 warnings in total. And that if I'm unable to make my windows 2 more times, I was going to be restricted from ever delivering for Amazon again. I quickly realized if I literally don't break the law in order to deliver these packages within the very, very constricted time window that Amazon has allowed me to deliver these packages in, I won't be able to work for them again. So they're in effect incentivizing me to break the law in order to make their deadlines. I quickly realized, okay, I can see how something like this can be both a good opportunity for people who need flexible work, but I also can see how this can quickly become exploitative and why this might be attracting a certain class of people.
That is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah. But again, I want to play devil's advocate here because I think it's a tough problem to solve because globalization has decimated small towns. It's destroyed communities. It exploits people, which I got a small glimpse into. But it also makes possible the kind of interconnected global trade and 24-hour next day delivery system that honestly helps a lot of people. Like if you were to go back 100 years and say to someone who was disabled or elderly or blind or couldn't leave their home for whatever reason, they were frail or infirm, et cetera, and you said that you could order whether it's life-saving medication or just something as ordinary as groceries or furniture, that you didn't have to leave your house in order to get those things that either you needed to live or just the luxuries of daily life that everyone is entitled to, that you could have those things delivered from across the world to you within a day or two, that would seem like a miracle to someone living 100, hell, even 30 years ago. Globalization does leave a lot of disaster in its wake, and it does exploit people, either in countries like the US and the UK, and especially in developing countries like the ones you've mentioned. But how do we preserve the good, the way that globalization has changed so many lives here and elsewhere for the better?
Yeah. So the whole premise of my book is really about how we take control of these large and unaccountable systems, make them more accountable, make them more fair and more sustainable and more democratic. So it's basically a call for the democratization of the economy. Part of that is, for example, imagining a system like Amazon, but one that is democratically owned and governed. Perhaps a workers' cooperative version of Amazon, where you have these examples of workers' cooperative versions of Uber, right? Where the workers band together and own the app, and then they are in much greater control over their conditions and also are holders in the returns from that company. Obviously, that sort of system is not going to be as insanely efficient as Amazon, but it's also not going to exploit loads of people. And also, crucially, I think a really interesting issue here is you mentioned the luxuries of daily life that we're all entitled to. Most of the stuff we order on Amazon is crap, basically.
True.
There are all these YouTube accounts that are dedicated to like these amazing finds I found on Amazon. And it's like a grape peeler or like these tiny little bits of plastic that have not particularly expansive uses, but which kind of make us feel good to consume and buy, even though they have a really negative impact on the environment and also have all of these other kind of exploitative things associated with them. And I think part of that, and again, looking at what Marx says about this, is that when we're really exploited in our work and when our work kind of centers around like this economy, which is all oriented around producing commodities, it's like we are hyper exploited to produce commodities. And as a result of that, we come to be obsessed with commodities themselves. So because the human being is oppressed and exploited in the production of commodities, commodities take on the same kind of symbolic importance as most societies would attach to human life, basically. So we seek to soothe ourselves from the horrendous systems that we've created just by constant consumption of things that we don't really need. And that's become such a massive problem today, whether you look at the fast fashion industry, for example, or obesity epidemics or whatever.
Just to yes and you here, Grace, it didn't really quite make sense to me until I learned what you're articulating here. One of the things that was really eye-opening for me is that oftentimes, at least here in America, poorer communities purchase more commodities on average than wealthier communities do. And I didn't quite understand that because initially I was like, well, why wouldn't they save this money more? Coming from my judgmental middle-class perspective. But once I understood that commodities were oftentimes a way to self-soothe when you felt like you had no way to escape the situation that you were born into, it made more sense.
Yeah, totally. And it's also worth bearing in mind that a lot of the commodities, you know, if you look at the percentage of people's incomes that are spent on stuff, it is often higher, lower down the income spectrum. But that's because there's a lot of stuff you need to survive, firstly, and that takes up a bigger portion of people's incomes when those incomes are smaller. They're not buying luxury goods, they're just buying things that they need. Secondly, they seek out commodities to help them to soothe themselves. But also, and I mean, as I'm sure that you will have noticed working for Amazon, so many employers require you to buy your own stuff just to be able to do your job. They require you to, as you saw, spend money on parking tickets because they require you to park illegally. There's so many costs, or actually something that we don't have here in the UK, but they require lots of money to be spent on health insurance, which again, we don't have because this is something that's socialized. But there are so many what were formerly socialized or collective costs, whether those are costs of the equipment for doing your job, the cost of education, the cost of healthcare, the cost of social care, that have been steadily privatized and have been forced onto the individual. And that always creates much more of a weight on individuals that are lower down the income spectrum, such that we're now in this situation where in the UK, we've just had this study that's shown that poverty has gone up substantially because of the cost of living crisis, because things are getting more expensive for people and their wages aren't keeping pace. And a quarter of children are living in absolute poverty, not relative poverty, absolute poverty. So they cannot afford the basic things that they need to survive. And the problem is even worse in America. The shocking thing about the US is that life expectancy is declining. That never happens in advanced growing economies. The iron law of wealth is supposed to be that as an economy gets wealthier, its population gets healthier and lives longer. But that isn't the case in the US because of these horrific inequalities that exist at the level of the economy, in health, just make some people's lives astonishingly difficult. And I think the tough thing is that we're all in our little bubbles, right? And it can be so hard to imagine what life is like for someone who is working for Amazon unless you've been there, or who is working in a poorly paid service sector job, or who is a single parent, or who's living in a difficult neighborhood, because you're very limited by the kind of communities within which you find yourself. And I guess my argument in this book is we need to actually go back to having like real communities. And what I mean by that is not like self-selected communities where you move into like a gated complex and you just hang out with your neighbors, but you should have mechanisms for creating real democratic structures within your workplaces and your communities, and also just making the government more democratic. So there should be forums for people to come together with fellow citizens to work out issues. And in doing so, you meet people who are not like you. The participatory budgeting movement is a great example of this, where local people were given the power to set their municipal budgets. And it started in Brazil. And all of these people came together and they put much more money into healthcare and education and drastically improved their local environments. And it was because this wide array of citizens from all different walks of life were forced to come together and discuss the things that were important to them and resolve those issues in a fair, reasonable, and democratic way. And that's something that we're really missing as individualism has taken over our societies.
You've mentioned Karl Marx here. You mentioned him in the book. You point to his criticisms of and insights into capitalistic societies. Communism, though, the word communism is only mentioned twice in the book, but that was Marx's ideal form of government, his ideal economic system. Democratic planning, is it different from communism? Is it the same? Is it a variation on that? Is it a rebranding? How does it differ?
The whole idea of communism in Marx's writing is not really laid out at all. It's this kind of ideal utopian scenario, which is like the end of history and everyone just comes together and conflict doesn't really happen anymore, at least over kind of economic things. And it's not really spelled out in much detail, partly because Marx realizes that the ways that we think about the world are shaped and determined by the kind of world we live in. So it's hard to imagine a different kind of society from within the constraints imposed by this society. So you can imagine ways to do things differently based on where you are now, but you can't really jump from here to utopia. And I think that's what this book is grounded in. It's based on the idea that any change that we want to see will only come when people build power that will allow them to counteract the concentrated power of elites. So basically, it's not starting them from the position of saying, imagine a perfect world and then tracing back, how do we get there? It's saying, look at the world we're in now, look at where power is, and let's figure out how we shift that power and start to bring it back down to everyone else from the way it is now, where that power is concentrated in a very small number of hands. And I think this is really the Marxist and socialist way of thinking, which is about how you build power in the world as it is now. It's not about imagining utopian different ways of organizing society. There is some of that in there, but like the real day-to-day work of most socialists has always been organizing in the world as it is today and trying to shape it in line with these ideals that are laid out in Marxist thinking, but not by coming up with exhaustive blueprints for how the world is going to look. It's like the grubby work of organizing trade unionists or building community enterprises at a local level. It's not the kind of sexy work that we're often treated to in these polemics about the economy of like coming up with radical new policy solutions and getting the government to implement it. I think that's partly where this book came from, is my frustration with reading the same book over and over again, which listed the same set of problems in the economy and then came up with a variation of the same set of policy solutions and said, all we need to do to change things is just have the government change the way that policy works. And I was just like banging my head against the wall, like, you don't understand how governments work. We have to understand capitalism as this whole system where what the government is doing is influenced by the balance of power in society. Unless you are helping people to build power from the ground up in order to hold our politicians to account, they're just going to carry on doing the things that benefit the corporations, no matter how many books you write telling them that they need to do things differently. So this is really a call to say, how do we build power now to hold those at the top to account?
So is what you're advocating for reform or revolution? Because you talk about reforms that can be done to our existing systems. But how do you wrestle power from, let's say, the boards of companies like Amazon or Apple or Microsoft or Boeing without violence? Violence in the most general terms, in that if I go to you and I say, all right, this is legally your company, but it is no longer, and you, Grace, tell me, no, I disagree, the only way that I can take it from you is either through force or through guaranteed force from the government. So how do we go about transforming towards a society that you're advocating for without violence if the very people who are in power are resistant to that change?
the point that you just highlighted, which is basically the ultimate guarantor of any government policy is and has to be violence, is true. The idea of forming a government, I suppose, is what you're saying, necessitates at least the idea of violence, if not the actuality of violence. Although, again, violence is meted out a lot today on certain populations. It's just like protesters and workers and like people who try to organize against the system. So I'm not saying that controlling government policy isn't important. What I am saying is that the only way to get there is to start from where we are now. So to start building power from the ground up. And I think part of this comes from like a wrestling with the legacy of Corbynism and like with the Sanders movement in the US, of seeing the election of particular candidates to positions of power as like a shortcut around the absence of any real building blocks of power in society as a whole, and how badly that failed. It was, I think, a wake-up call for a lot of people of like, oh, okay, we can't just pick someone, try and get them elected and get them to do loads of good policies. That's not the shortcut that we think it is. We're not going to be able to change society just from the top down, just like how the neoliberals tried to change society. We need to have a revolution that is rooted in the lives of ordinary people. And in that sense, I am advocating for revolution, not violent revolution, but revolution in the way that people see themselves and the world and each other. And that's ultimately way more important. If you look at the way that the state exercises power today, most of the time, violence is still important, but most of the time it doesn't rely on violence. It relies on these kind of subtle mechanisms to change the way people think. And I look up about that a lot in the book, about all the ways that the free market turn changed the way we think and the way we relate to each other. And one of the biggest things that it did was encourage us not to see ourselves as workers, but as entrepreneurs or capitalists, to encourage us not to see ourselves as communities, but as households, not as citizens, but as consumers of services. It was this shift from kind of collectivism to individualism that has cut us off from each other and made us feel like all of the problems that are in the world are just our own individual fault. And the only things that we can do about those problems take place on an individual level. So it's buy things differently or hustle to earn more money or whatever. And I suppose the revolution, in inverted commas, I'm calling for is a revolution that combines respect for the dignity and autonomy of the individual with a move towards collectivism and real democracy. So it's a revolution in the sense of understanding that we are not isolated, atomized individuals who are just entirely and solely responsible for everything that happens to us. We live in a society. We are responsible to one another. And the ways that we interact with one another and the decisions that we make as part of our collective social institutions affects all of us. They affect us individually and they affect us collectively. And I want us to really start grappling with these questions of power, basically. If we want to change the world, it has to start by people coming together and demanding that things change, because we cannot continue to expect to go to those at the top of society with begging bowls saying, please change this one policy or please make sure that we have access to healthcare, because they have no incentive to do it for as long as we don't have the power to demand it.
The idea of the increasing atomization within society and our disconnection from one another is a recurring theme of this podcast. And I think a five alarm fire here in America, and I imagine in the UK, and the idea of us becoming, I don't know, portals for or enablers of sheer consumerism as a replacement for, and I'm saying this as an atheist, religion, community, family, it's really troubling and gross. And so I'm 100% with you there. And it's difficult in this conversation, Grace, to be the one arguing for moderation, because one always risks being looked back from the future as the guy saying, you know, hey, we need to figure out a moderate incremental way to phase out slavery. So I don't want to be that guy. But the thing that's always in the back of my mind, and I'm sure you are well familiar with this, is the rule of Chesterton's fence, thinking about second and third order effects of this sort of thing. How do we preserve the good while we reform the bad? To loop back to something you said a second ago, the general theory of democratic planning, and I hope that I'm doing your idea justice here. The good and the bad thing about democracy is that everyone gets a say. And there are, and I'm sure you've talked with these very people, there are a lot of people out there who would disagree with you vehemently. And I'm using general you. It could apply to me. Dislike you, hate you. Everything that you stand for, they're against. Generally, really bad people, even just setting aside people with criminal intent, just people with really bad ideas. And that's the sloppy, messy thing about democracy. When I'm talking about preserving the good, if we're to reform the system in such a way while giving everyone a say, what happens if through the very power of democracy, people with really bad ideas overpower you.
When you talk about preserving the good, we need to think about what the good is. And the good is basically us. All of the good that exists in this system comes from the good that is done by human beings, just as the bad in this system comes from the bad that is done by these systems that we've constructed that encourage human beings to behave in particular ways. So if we want more good, we have to design systems that facilitate good. And I think what you've just been speaking about shows that the way that we've designed systems today brings out the bad a lot of the time. And the reason for that is the combination of individualism and mass communication. So we all see ourselves as isolated individuals. We're very obsessed with defining our own identity in distinction to other people, because you don't have a kind of preconceived identity that much anymore. You have to pick who you are, what you do and what you wear and all these kind of things. And you have to foreground certain things to say, this is who I am. And in doing so, you place yourself in opposition to groups who define themselves differently. Now, historically, you would have been in direct communication with those people who disagree with you. They would have been your neighbors, your coworkers, even if you didn't like them because you thought they were up themselves or stupid or whatever. You didn't like the way that they dressed or whatever. You would still have had to communicate with them. And the fact of your communicating with them face to face would have allowed you to realize that they are a person. They want the same things as you. You know, you're all part of this community. You have to get along to make sure that the company works or the village works or whatever. Today, we don't have that. We just have you're an individual, you pick an identity, and then you're able to enter these spaces where your identity is directly counterposed with the identity of someone else. And you're divided into these massive warring groups of two sets of people. And you never really come into contact with members of the other group. And if you do, it's in really unhuman ways. And my theory as to how we preserve the good of what is in this system and get rid of the bad is that all of this has to start, as I've said, at the grassroots level with conversations and movements that are built amongst people. And when you build those movements amongst people, again, and I look at all these different examples of experiments in democratic planning that take place at a local level, at a firm level. Participatory budgeting is one of them. The Lucas Plan is another. There's the Green Ban movement in Australia. In Iceland, they came up with this idea of better neighborhoods where everyone came together and voted on policies. And placing people together in these environments where they are forced to recognize each other's humanity, recognize that they are dependent upon each other, that they cannot survive alone, that they have to work together, and that they need to come up with a solution to a problem. It often encourages moderation. So it will mean that the solutions that come out of that will often be less radical initially than perhaps the ones that I would design if I had a blackboard on my own. But they also arise from a recognition of, as I said, like our mutual interdependence and our mutual humanity, basically. And that's why I think real democracy is so important in this transition to a fairer society, because it's the only thing that's rooted enough to be sustainable. And also it's the only thing that's going to be powerful enough to be able to resist the people at the top. Because again, that popular pressure that's built up when people come together and form movements is something that elites have to pay attention to.
It sounds like the core, the crux, the first step of how we accomplish what you're envisioning is to start with the self as an internal revolution, a revolution of how we see ourselves and how we see each other. Or as Carrie Cunnington said to you in 2021, quote, "It's not rocket science, it's just community." End quote. In the early 2000s, there were small towns throughout Wales, much like there are here in the US, that were left behind by globalization. What ended up happening in the villages in and around Ffestiniog, and how is it a vision of the kind of democratic planning we've discussed today?
Again, the reason I'm highlighting these things is not because the transition to a fairer economy at the macro level is going to come just from lots of experiments in democratic planning. It's because, as I've said, there is this need to create communities and movements that can take on the power of those at the top. And the only way that happens is when you start organizing locally. And also, these movements can do good things for the people that are involved in them. In fact, that's a lot of the time the only reason that people do get involved with them. So somewhere like Blaenau Ffestiniog, which is this small village in North Wales, it was like a former slate mining town, very poor. Politicians came and went saying, this is a left behind town, what can we do? Eventually, the local people in the community took matters into their own hands and started forming community enterprises, cooperatives. They started a community energy company that made use of hydroelectric power and reinvented and reimagined their community. And suddenly everyone started paying attention and being like, wow, this is amazing. And then they were able to act like a big corporation, less powerful, but still they organized within the Welsh government to say, this is what we need. We need more of this. You need to give it to us. So there was this transition from this local movement that was about ameliorating people's conditions to this political movement that was about changing the way that society worked. And I think that is the way that we need to think about these things. Everyone approaches the problems with the world basically wanting easy solutions. And by easy solutions, I don't mean technically easy solutions. I mean solutions that don't require us to think about power, that don't require us to think about how people actually work or how political change actually happens. And it's so easy to say, we want a wealth tax and that's going to fix the global economy, like someone like Piketty says, for example. But again, as I keep coming back to throughout this book and throughout this conversation, that's not going to happen if we don't start with people. And as you said, the self, but not just the self as part of a community. Maybe the first awakening comes in the self, maybe by reading my book, you realize that you're not this isolated, atomized individual. That doesn't change anything until you start organizing with other people. And I'm really passionate and excited about the next phase of this project, trying to shine a light on people doing just that and allowing them to connect to one another.
What you said earlier a moment ago about how thinking about ourselves in relation to our communities and thinking about our communities differently and those around us differently is so vital. I'd like to just pull a quote from an interview you did with The Guardian. It starts, quote, "Halfway through writing her new book, Vulture Capitalism, Grace Blakely had what her mom called a midlife crisis." And then you go on to say, quote, "I realized that the stuff that I was doing and the way that I was making sense of what I was doing was having a really negative impact on me and on my mental health. Just everything, feeling constantly on edge, not really being able to engage with people in honest and open ways. There was a point at which I was like, I don't know if I can do this anymore," end quote. And I relate to that on a very deep level, and it gets to the heart of why I started this show in the first place. I feel that much of our division today, to a point you made earlier, is driven by our need to root our identities often in our political labels, which leads to this tribalistic us versus them thinking. And so then when it comes to trying to have discussions around really important, vital topics like how we form our economies, our communities, we don't actually discuss the ideas at all. I recently spoke with Carlos Lozada. He's this Pulitzer Prize winning opinion columnist who covers Washington, D.C. And he notes, I think really insightfully, how counterproductive our obsession with this labeling is because it forecloses insight, wisdom, empathy, and ultimately compromise. So my question is, since that midlife crisis, and I certainly hope it's not really a midlife crisis since 60 seems like a very young age to die, how have you shifted in how you think about your colleagues in politics, people who disagree with you? And how do you now strive for open, honest, and vulnerable conversations with those with whom you disagree?
It's a great question. The shift has come less from viewing other people differently, and it's come more from just thinking less about their criticisms and more about honoring what I'm trying to say, speaking from the heart. Now, that doesn't mean not listening. Obviously, it is important to listen just to be able to engage with any debate. But there is a difference between listening to the people who are arguing against you in a kind of open way and thinking, is what they're saying a critique that aligns with my values? Or is it a critique that comes from their values, which are different to mine, and being able to differentiate between those two things? And then responding not from a position of defensiveness, but from a position of openness. So I think the classic thing would be to be like, we're a group over here, they're the enemies over there, everything they think is wrong, everything we think is right. And when they try and argue with us, we get defensive because we're trying to defend everything that we believe and all of our position. And you get into a big argument and it looks messy for everyone and it doesn't really convince anyone. Whereas my position now is that I am part of a social movement that foregrounds particular values. And there are people who are part of different social movements that foreground very different values. And some of those people are doing that in an honest and genuine way. A lot of them are paid up lobbyists for big corporations, but that doesn't really matter. What matters is listening and engaging with what people are saying. And then rather than responding or reacting, just allowing that to settle and then speaking from your heart and speaking from your values. I won't allow myself to get dragged into arguments anymore. I won't allow myself to get dragged into the position of defending myself against a perceived attack. I just think I'm in this position to communicate an idea. I believe that idea to be very powerful. People may disagree with me and they may bring up problems with that idea or alternatives. And it is up to me to respond to that in a calm and open way. But I'm not defending myself. I'm not defending my identity. I am acting as a mouthpiece for these ideas. I think it's really important that people are able to hear in the best and most effective way possible. So I'm thinking less about, in inverted commas, the enemy or like the people on the other side of the debate. They're going to do what they're going to do. That's fine. I don't let that upset me. I'm just thinking about how I communicate my message and making sure that I do that in the most open and honest way possible.
Before we started recording, I said to you that I started this book with some resistances, something I always try and keep in mind. Discussed previously in this podcast, it was a tactic that I learned from a directing teacher of mine many years ago, that whether you're analyzing a script or I suppose any kind of text, that while you're doing that, to keep very careful attention to any resistances you might have to it, and then recognize those resistances, make note of them, and then investigate, okay, where are these resistances coming from and why do I have them, right? What I loved so much about your book, Grace, and just the general way you approach these topics, as I've familiarized myself with your work through interviews and articles, this book is not a polemic and it's not dogmatic. The best, truest compliment I can give it, and your work in general, is that it is something that is increasingly, depressingly rare. It is a very fair book. I found myself, at least initially, you'd be talking about Marx, Hayek, Keynes, whatever, and I'd feel myself anticipating, okay, well, yeah, but what about this? And then almost comically, the very next paragraph, or sometimes next sentence, it was like you were reading my mind. It's like you anticipated my question or my resistance and you addressed it. And too often, whether I'm reading something conservative, liberal, progressive, et cetera, whatever it is, it feels like the author is either willingly or ignorantly just completely ignoring the other point of view. And you never did that. Even while you were advocating for your own position, you always kept in mind that there were people out there who were going to be reading your book who thought differently from you, and you respected them enough to call that out. And so I just want to say thank you for such a fair-minded book. Thank you for advocating for what you believe in, even if I don't agree with all of it. I'm genuinely appreciative that there are people out there like you who exist, who genuinely care about the world and how society is formed and how we can form it in the future. And most of all, Grace, today, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me and for just an incredibly kind and generous review of the book. I really appreciate that came through. And yeah, thank you so much for the interview. It's been really great talking to you.
It was my pleasure.